The Transfiguration is one of a kind. One day, 2,000 years ago, in the middle of Jesus' ministry, on an ordinary afternoon, he shone like the sun for a fleeting moment. It is a unique, once-upon-a-time sort of event. Analogies are always inadequate. But did you make it to the Geneva Light Show? Anyone? A few of you at least. For a few weekends at the start of this year, lights shimmered around the shores of the lake in the evening. There were hundreds of tiny bulbs that bounced like fireflies on a plot of grass. There were moving images projected onto a spray of water. There was a glowing hoop you could walk through as it changed colors. There was a kaleidoscopic rainbow of a spider's web. But the star of the show was the whale. Anybody see that? I am not sure what he was made of, maybe some kind of enormous cloth balloon, but he dipped and dived and danced from one shore of the lake to the other. At first, from far away, I wasn't sure if he was also a projection himself, some sort of laser-powered image. But my kids spotted the strings, connecting the creature to a small boat on the lake beneath, where operators were moving him sort of like a giant marionette and making him go this way and that way and rise and fall. This whole production was impressive and beautiful, but what really struck me about it was the awe and delight that it clearly stirred up for those of us who were there. There were gasps and laughter from all around, from kids and grown-ups alike. We were more than just impressed. We were jolted out of our ordinary experience and graced by a bit of joy. Not a bad way to spend a Friday evening. Like I said, the Transfiguration is one of a kind, and analogies are always inadequate, but maybe the light show gives us sort of a sideways entrance into this familiar story. It is certainly an awe-inspiring scene. Jesus grabs three of his closest friends one day and hauls them up a mountain. It seems as though they had no idea the purpose of this trek when they began, but I'm guessing that was sort of regular business for the disciples. Jesus was always bringing them one place or another, this village or that house or that boat, and they had probably learned by now that they would soon enough figure out why. The four of them are on top of the mountain by themselves until suddenly they're not. Moses and Elijah are there too, great prophets of the people from centuries ago. And Jesus is shining with an otherworldly brilliance. Peter recognizes that something very special is happening. How could you not? And he makes the very understandable proposal to honor the moment by building something for these three glowing figures. But before he can get started, a cloud descends, obscuring everything, and a voice speaks. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." And just like that, it's all over. Once again, it's just the four of them. No one is shining, no voice is booming, and it is time to head back down the hill. Awe is a word that easily comes to mind for me when it comes to this story. The details are so fantastic, so strange and amazing. Heavenly lights and long-gone prophets, mysterious clouds, and a disembodied voice. We can understand why Peter struggled with what to say, and James and John just kept their mouths shut. They all finally leave the mountain puzzled and wondering what in the world this all can mean. It's an awe-inspiring scene for sure. But let's not miss the possibility of delight here as well. Awe and delight often go together, after all. New Testament professor Matt Skinner notes that love animates the voice speaking from the cloud. "This is my son, the beloved." For some reason, I think we always default to imagining a voice from the heavens as deep and booming and deadly serious. But it could just as well have been gentle and kind and firm. Whatever this voice sounded like, it is a voice of love, a voice with a smile behind it. This is my child. This is one I delight in. This is my beloved. Maybe the disciples caught that too. Maybe they knew something a little like that mix of awe and delight we felt while the whale came soaring across the lake. Maybe they found their spirits not only struck with amazement, but also lifted in joy. I mean, they're getting a glimpse here behind the great curtain, a look into the deeper reality of things, where this poor traveling teacher and healer is revealed for who he truly is, God's own, shining in glory. It must have been a profound and rich experience, transformative even, something one could treasure and hold dear for life. And I kind of imagine they needed it, because you know where the story is going from here. We are precisely smack dab in the middle of Mark's gospel, and while Jesus still has blessing and healing to do, his focus has begun to change. He has started talking about his betrayal and death. And just two chapters later, perhaps a matter of weeks or months, he and his disciples will enter Jerusalem, where he will confront the powerful for the last time and find himself executed as a criminal. Mark's version of the story will end with an empty tomb and everybody baffled and confused and terrified. It's a very hard road ahead for Jesus, of course, and also for his disciples. Their world is soon going to be turned upside down. And I can imagine that in such a disorienting time, an experience like the one on the mountaintop would have been immensely valuable. When everything seemed to be coming apart, they could at least look back on what they'd seen that day. They could come back to that loving voice, calling them to trust and to listen. Remember that? They could say to themselves, at least we have that moment to hold on to. It must have been precious beyond words. Which leaves me with a question. How come only three of the disciples were included? Why did these three alone get to peek behind the curtain? I mean, if Jesus could bring three friends up a mountain, why couldn't he bring a whole bunch more? What about all the others? I don't have an answer, of course. There is no way of knowing why only a few of Jesus' followers were there to see him with Moses and Elijah and to hear the voice from the cloud proclaiming him beloved. But I think there is something important to notice here about how God works. God is faithful, declares this story. The God who created the world in love and gave the law in love and sent the prophets in love has sent Jesus in love as well. In the face of Jesus Christ, as Paul writes, we are given light of the knowledge of the glory of God. In him, every one of God's promises is a yes. God is faithful. But as this story reminds us, we are not all given the same glimpses of what that faithfulness looks like. Peter, James, and John had their particular experience entrusted only to them. It was their task to share it with others. Not right away, Jesus says, but rather after his death, which is sort of a confusing topic, maybe for another time. It was their task to share this experience with others someday, and it was the task of others to receive it. I think there's something very countercultural at work here. Seeing is believing, we say. If you didn't take a picture, it didn't happen. We want proof. We want verification. We want our own firsthand experience. And that's not always wrong, I think. In the Gospel of John, Thomas is absent when the others encounter Jesus newly risen at Easter, and he says he needs his own experience in order to believe. Jesus certainly doesn't fault him or shame him for that. It's okay to wish for our own direct experiences of God's faithfulness in our lives. But what a gift we miss if we don't attend to the ways others have experienced God's faithfulness as well. Presumably one day, in the chaos that followed the discovery of the empty tomb, Peter and James and John sat down with the other disciples and told them what they'd seen on the mountaintop. about the light and the cloud and the voice, about the awe and delight it had stirred up in them in that fleeting moment. And the others could have said they didn't believe it, that since there were no photos to prove it, it couldn't be true. That's their right. They could take that stance. But what a gift they would be missing. Because instead, they could recognize that in the experience of their friends, God's faithfulness was there to be seen. God's faithfulness not just to those three, but to all of them, to all people, to creation itself. They could let the particular way in which their friends had known God's goodness cheer and encourage and sustain them in the difficult path they were facing. And I think that's an important word for us. We all go through difficult seasons. Our world is torn by division and injustice, violence and greed. We all struggle to see God's presence at times. But God is faithful, and the glimpses granted to others are gifts for us as well. When a friend speaks about how she has found new hope after a time of grief, or a member of the congregation tells about experiencing the depth of God's mercy in a new way, or a church in some other part of the world shares about finding guidance and provision through hardship, we're to listen, and listen well, because any story of God's faithfulness is a gift, no matter who was there to see it. Each one points to God's essential character, after all, gracious and merciful, abounding in steadfast love. Each one reminds us of who God is, and that reminder may be just what we need to keep going through whatever it is we are facing right now. The Transfiguration is one of a kind. I'm guessing none of us here have had an experience exactly like this, but we are invited today to be cheered and encouraged and upheld by the witness of others, that one day, long ago, light pierced this world, revealing Jesus in glory, shining with power and love. We are invited to bask in the light of that testimony and to find ourselves once again awed and delighted by the faithfulness of our God. It is a great gift, friends, for us all. Thanks be to God. Amen.